Welcome to Tribal Histories, a Wisconsin Public Television original production adapted for Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Comfort. These stories were recorded in the natural settings of the regions that Native people have called home for centuries. Tribal members share their challenges, triumphs, and time-honored traditions that have shaped their vibrant communities across generations. Today, we hear the histories of the Lac-Di-Flambeau Ojibwe and of the Brotherton Nation. On the bank of Crawling Stone Lake, Ernie St. Germain shares stories handed down by the Lac-Di-Flambeau Ojibwe. He tells of the migration from Madeline Island to their present-day location and remembers the volatile spearfishing controversy. Then, Joan Shadowald tells how the Brotherton Indians unknowingly gave up their tribal recognition status and have been working for 30 years to have it restored. Lac-Di-Flambeau Ojibwe and the Brotherton history coming up after the news. Welcome to Tribal Histories. First, Ernie St. Germain shares the oral tradition of the Lac-Di-Flambeau Ojibwe.
Now, one of the things unique about the people over here with all of this water was they used torches for spearing at night. The white pine pitch in birch extended out there and light that up. And of course, the fish are pretty curious. And the one that was easiest was walleye, because their eyes reflected that light. There were so many canoes out there on the lake in the evening after the sun went down. When the French came into this area and started discovering us, they looked out on the waters here and they saw all those torches out there, those fire pots. They were amazed by it because there were so many. One of them said Lac-Di-Flambeau, the Lake of Flames. And so that is what they called this place. But long before that, we were known as Waswagon, the people of the torch. I'm Ernie St. Germain. I'm enrolled here in Lac-Di-Flambeau. I didn't grow up here. I grew up over in my mother's reservation over at Lakota Ray. That's my matrilineal side over there. And my patrilineal side is here in Lac-Di-Flambeau. So I was always drawn here, I guess. From the time I was little, I was always curious about this place. And after I graduated from college, then I was coaching baseball down at Stout and working down there. And I came up here one weekend to visit my grandpa, and he asked me when I was going to move home. And I thought about it, and so I stuck around on Monday morning. I went up and met the tribal chairman, introduced myself, and told him my grandpa was, and I said I graduated from college and was interested in coming home and wondering if there was any jobs or anything, and he says, hold on. We drove over to the school, the grade school, walked right into the administrator's office. What had happened was Al had told him, you bring me an educated Indian and I'll hire him. And that was the first test. And so one day I was at the school and at work, and this young girl came in and she peeked around the corner and she looked at me and I looked at her and she said, so grandma wants to see you then. I said, oh, and she disappeared, took off running. And so I asked my boss, who was that girl? She said, that was Jerry Kay. And she says, the grandma she's talking about is Josephine. And she lives out in the village. She says, oh, okay. I just went to the store and I bought a little bag of flour and I drove out to the old village. I went up on the porch and I knocked on the door. And I had that bag of flour. And the just the screen door, and the door was open. So somebody was home. I knocked on the door again, gently. There was no answer. And so I sat the bag of flour on the railing and left. And the next day, Jerry Kay came back again, and she looked at me and she says, well, Grandma still wants to see you. And so this time I got some lard and took it back and went back up again and knocked on the door again. And I thought I saw the curtain move this time, which was right over there. And wasn't quite sure, and so I left the lard. And I came back again the next day, and I had salt this time. And as I came walking up the porch to the screen door, she was standing in the screen door this time, looking at me, this little short grandma, looking at me, and she said, "Bindi Gane." So I came in. She invited me to come in. And just like we always knew each other, we just started talking like we've always been there. What I had done is I brought her the beginnings of the recipe for fry bread. Next time I came, she had fry bread for me. She knew. And she was like the greatest resource for me discovering my identity here at Waswaganing. She told me those old stories. And of course, there's humorous stories, and there's wintertime stories about it. It has its own history. Most of the time, I didn't have to have a question. If I went and talked to her, she always knew what was in my heart and always knew what to talk about. It seemed like if she started talking about something that I didn't have on my mind, eventually it was a just incredibly valuable piece of information for me. And it was something about this land, this place. And I wanted to know about Kishkiman, that leader that brought us here. And so she sent me up the road to another old man up there. His name was Madweaki Ewing, Joe Kelty. And people had a nickname for him. They called him Ding Man. And he just knew that I wanted to know about Kishkiman. He told me a story that took, I don't know, measure in terms of months, how many moons it took for him to tell that story, but it was of how we got here. It went all the way back to when the people were up on that big island that today they call Madeline Island. He went back way beyond that. And those stories are handed down of that history, how we got here. They say that at that one point, when everyone was there, when they all, some came around the north and some came around the south of the lake, and when they met and congregated there, they say there were over 20,000 Anishinaabe, all the clans represented on that island. And of course, that small piece of land isn't going to sustain that many people for very long, and they started to scatter and move out. And the different clan headmen sent runners out continually looking for a home for the clan. When you hear me tell about the clans and the different animals, you have to understand how important the clans are to our identity and to who we are. Long, what they say, Mewija, long ago, way, way back, the people were losing who they are, were losing the importance of family. Family was disintegrating, and Creator knew that. And so Creator sent a messenger among the people, and that messenger was Negig, the otter, and sent Otter to come to the people and tell them that there's going to come these teachers to the people. And the people didn't really believe it too much, and so Ngig had to do a bunch of things. And I tell you that story, we could go on here for days. But Ngig convinced the people. And so they all gathered there together and waited. And then the first teacher came out of the waters. And the people were just amazed. And the teacher started teaching. And it was incredible, the stuff that this teacher was telling them. The stories and the instructions and how to be Anishinaabe again. But you know, no matter who you are and how good your story and what you had to say, to some people, every word of that teaching just inspired them and they couldn't stop listening, while others, their mind wanders off. And so in the end, when the teacher is done and returns back to the water, there are some people that have listened to every word and remember every word. And so the second teacher came and the same thing happened. Only different people listened to every word this time. And the third teacher, and the fourth, and the fifth, and the sixth. And those that listened to the first teacher took on the instructions and took on the responsibility of that teaching. And they took on the identity of that teaching. And eventually they took an animal identity of that teacher. And that first teacher that came out is Ajijak, the crane, became the Crane Clan. And those are the orators, the teachers, the stargazers. They watch the stars, they're the philosophers, speakers. You put a camera on them and they'll talk all day. Then the second teacher was Mung, the loon. And the responsibility of loon, there are many, but the most important one is to listen to what's happening and to listen to Ajijak and make sure that what Ajijak is saying is done the right way. If they start to go haywire, loon straightens them out. Then the third teacher became the Bear Clan. That one, the males are the guardians. They guard the door. They're like the police force, but you never cross them. They have great courage. And the women are just the opposite of them, but the same at the same time. They're the nurturers. And then the fourth one is the Fish Clan. In your Fish Clan, the king of the Fish Clan is the sturgeon. And we have a very close relationship with sturgeon. They are the doctors. They will doctor your physical being and they'll doctor your heart also. And then we have Martin. Martin Clan are the Ogichida and Ogichidakwe. Those are the warriors. And of course, we all have Ogichida in us, but not like the Martin Clan. You go to Bear Clan to settle disputes. But when nothing is left and when there's nothing left to be done, you go to Martin Clan and they'll take care of it and it'll be over with. So then the sixth clan is Wawashkeshi, the deer. And the deer are the balance of Martin. They are the peacemakers. And the Deer Clan over time began to feel like they were better than the others. They were above. They became aloof. They became so good. They became so self-centered, conceited, that eventually they began to think that the other clans were beneath them, And so they began to intermarry. You have to marry outside of your clan. That's one of the major rules. So the clans all got together, and Deer Clan was cast out. There is no more Deer Clan. It's gone. It doesn't exist. And so our peacemakers, our true peacemakers, are gone. We can only hope for a little bit of peace. You know, to teach everyone that that's... Yeah, there's a peacemaker right there. Yeah. You talk about it long enough and they come around. Those spirits like to hear those teachings. So that clan that came here, Kishkiman, was Crane Clan. And out there on Flambeau Lake, where the river goes out from the lake, it's there that he stood on a stone and looked out, and he said, this is where we're meant to be. So long as the stone is here, we will be here. And if we treat it the right way, it'll always be here. One day, Dingman said, let's go for a walk. So we went up the trail that went behind his house, and we're walking up that old trail. And it must have been an old cart road or something, because it was dug into the side. And as we're going along, he would stop and tell me what family had a lodge here. And there's graves right there. And we go a little ways, and he would tell me another family lived here, and there's graves right there. So we went along that trail. All of a sudden, we came back down a point, and he said, take off your shoes. And I did. He said, no. Stand on that rock. And I stood on that rock. He said, now look around. And I did. And he said, right there is where Kishkiman stood and said, this is where we'll always be. And I was standing in those, that very spot. And I think that one moment is what really, really connected me with this Swaganing, this place of the torch people. It helped me to understand that my people were here. This is how we got here. This is the home of my clan. This is where I'll always be. People hear the history of Waswaganing, Kishkiman coming here and seeing all of the water and the lakes and the Bear River, using those torches for spearing at night. And so that tradition was important. But everyone knew that before you went out on the waters in the spring, just before the ice goes out, you go put your tobacco there. And for your own family, you do water ceremony. So that Wendigo won't harm your family during this next open water season, so that no one will be harmed by the waters. And so even today, these young fishermen that go out in the spring, they put their tobacco down, asking permission to come there to feed the people, to feed their families. They won't do any harm out there, anything bad. They go there for a purpose. And that's why in the late 70s, why the Anishinaabe took the treaties and began to exercise the treaties, because more and more of us were becoming educated and reading and translating and interpreting what was written and seeing things that were never told to us before. You could begin to think about it, and the original purpose was to protect the rights that Indians have always had. And so rights were not given to the Indian. Indians retained rights. So it's rights retained, not rights given. And a lot of those rights were being taken away, the fishing and hunting and gathering, from laws that were passed by the state, which didn't have the ability to impose those on tribal people. Went to court, and the tribes won in the end. Along the way, there were a lot of sportsmen who, and you know, tavern owners and tourism that were extremely threatened by the idea of Indians exercising those rights in the ceded territory because it threatened tourism. We're going to go spear all the fish in that lake and there'll be none left, and the tourists won't come here to fish anymore, and we're going to go belly up. And that was the panic. So that panic led to a frenzy, and I see people today that were there on the boat landing screaming and calling names and shooting wrist rockets at the spears, and they're saying, I was there just to protect the fish. I wasn't racist. And, yep. But those signs were still there, and pictures of them are still there, and screaming obscenities. And it was an ugly time in our history. Very, very ugly time, but an important time. People expressed that because they didn't know the treaties themselves. And so we knew that a lot of us had to go about teaching what the treaty said and what they mean and how they're actually going to protect a lot of things here, preserve the environment rather than deplete the environment. I think the greatest thing that happened that came from it was the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. They do just an amazing amount of education, scientific work. They're doing studies continually and counts, monitoring the lakes and the forests like nothing has ever been done before, and showing and have proven that the spearing and the hunting hasn't affected the resources at all. In fact, the management of them has improved. I think if you go over and take a look at our fish hatchery, which has been stocking the lakes, restocking for a long, long time, that management is doing just wonderful things for all of the resources. You know, my grandpa wasn't a citizen of the United States, and he went and served in World War I. And he came home a veteran, having served this country, of which he wasn't a citizen, and came back and was treated like an Indian. Like, you know, you're a worthless Indian. But yet, what did it really mean to him? Because he had his identity. And that was the most important thing to him, is that identity, that clan identity and understanding of Anishinaabe. And being Anishinaabe is more than going to a powwow on a weekend and coming home and saying, I practiced my culture this weekend. It's every moment of your life. Understanding how you are a part of the circle of creation. And so he gave that to his son, and that tradition has always been passed down. And he told me how his father, my great-grandfather, Ojanime Gijik, gave it to him, and he went all the way back this line of our clan and talked about them and how important they were, and I was amazed by that. What he was doing was telling me my identity, knowing and hearing stories about my great-grandfather. If one day I live my life right, I may be able to talk to my great-grandchild and tell my great-grandchild about my great-grandfather. How many generations have I connected? Seven. I've connected seven generations, and that's what he told me is important. As long as I live, my family and my kids and my grandchildren, they're going to learn this way. And they're going to hear it over and over and over again. And I know they're going to roll their eyes and say, we've heard this before, but I'm still going to tell it over and over again until the day comes. I start to tell the story and they pick it up and they tell it. That's the day I know that they know it too. So that's my hope.
You're listening to Tribal Histories. The storyteller you just heard was Ernie St. Germain from the Lac des Flambeaux Ojibwe. Next, Joan Shadowald with the Brotherton history.
I used to go to the secondhand stores and to the bookstores and everything, and I'd go to the back of the book and I'd find Brotherton. Okay, buy it, get it, take it, rummage sale anywhere. So I've got a whole shelves of the books because I really thought I could come together with the true story, and then the oral history is another thing. But the thing that I benefited the most from is going out to the East Coast and going into the Hamilton College, and they had professors, they had anthropologists, historians, and the documents there in rare books, you have to wait for them to go down and bring it up with the white gloves on. Now that I can believe. They welcomed a whole busload of us that went out there and presented us with banquets, with welcome home after 150 years. We're together a lot today. Our community has grown to the point that we have our own bingo hall. We have our community center in Fond du Lac, which is our only source of income plus donations and contributions from people within the tribe. We make our own crafts to sell, or we have benefits, fundraisers, that type of thing. We have no one that's sponsoring us, you know, to later build a casino, because that really isn't what we want. We just want to be identified again as what we had been in the past. Well, my name is Joan Shadowald. 81 years ago, President Roosevelt just came in to become president. Prohibition had ended, and I was born. I was born in an area that was called Indian Town because of the fact that when my ancestors, who were the Brotherton, and I am a Brotherton, emigrated from New York to Wisconsin, my ancestors arrived a little bit later. And so the land was already patented out, and they moved on from Wisconsin to Minnesota. And that area where our home was, where my father was born, and I was born in the same house as he was the land that had previously been occupied by the Sioux Indians before their conflict with the European settlers. And they were removed, and the land was vacant. The soldiers that fought there, the generals and whatever, purchased the land and offered it for sale, half price of what it would cost to settle in Wisconsin. Today, the Brothertown Indian Nation is headquartered in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. We're governed by our constitution, and we have an enrollment criteria. The Brothertown are all direct descendants of the historic Indian tribes that were in the northeast part of what is now the United States when the first Europeans arrived. I was out on a trip not too long ago. We were taken to see this soapstone quarry, and they had a bowl that they had officially identified as a 4,000-year-old item that was probably touched by one of my ancestors. So that would have been 2,000 years in my mind before Christ. So then from that time until the first Europeans came, they lived there. So they've been around a long time. But when the European settlers came over, they were escaping three important things. One was the wars that were going on in Europe, France fighting with England and all the other countries involved, and class distinction, and then religious persecution. They came over for their reasons, personally, and also because they were asked to come over by the colonists. We were a colony of King George III at that time, and they were asking people to come over because they needed before we had money, cash money and all of these ATM machines, everything was gauged by land. So England wanted the land. It made them wealthier. France wanted it. And they were fighting over who was going to have control of it, which meant then they needed the Indians to cooperate with them and become a colony, and they did with the English. And that was successful for a short time, but then so many came over that there wasn't enough room for the Indians and the settlers. They had the theory that they were the chosen people that were coming over. It was destined that they were the people to decide how they could, like, take the land into their possession, and it didn't matter how they did it. They needed that land for the thousands and the millions that were going to be there years from that time. But the Indians didn't cooperate because it was their land and it was cultivated. They had their homes there. It was just a situation that was so unusual. They did have an Indian entity there, which was a nation of its own, the Six Nation Iroquois Nation. In fact, the government of the United States of America, with Ben Franklin and George Washington and all of them, took the same theory of governing from them. The one high power. Today we have representatives and senators. Back then they had, each tribe had a representative that came to the meeting. They worked as a nation. If anyone attacked one of the tribes, all the tribes joined together to defend that one tribe. And that's what we do in the United States. So anyway, when it came to a point before the American Revolution, about 1773, there was a Mohican minister, Samson Occum, that had gone to a Christian church, became an ordained minister, spoke English, who wisely could see that they weren't going to survive fighting to stay as they were, but if they took on some of the what they call the English ways, they would be treated differently and they would be able to maintain their identity. So what they did then was they sort of compromised, I guess you might say. But after a time, that didn't work. So in Farmington, Connecticut, which is the gathering place, and I saw also what they call the Tunksix Indians that live there, which means the same thing. And five other tribes, there's six tribes plus this Mohican minister that were part of what they called the praying villages. They had accepted Christianity and they were dying out from the diseases that were brought over that they weren't immune from. And the wars that they participated in between the French and the English decimated their populations. They had meetings and they came to the conclusion in 1773 that they were going to move farther west and establish, along with the Oneidas, who were already in New York, what they would call their own confederacy, similar to the Six Nation Iroquois. And the tribes that were involved were the tribes from Rhode Island, Connecticut, and New York. The Mohican, the Montauk, the Narragansett, the Niantic, the Pequots, and then those Tunksix Indians that were from Farmington. The Seven Nations then made an agreement with a superintendent of Indian Affairs for the colony, British colony, which they were, and he had written it up for how the Oneidas then agreed to take these Seven Nations. There was money involved and land involved in the deals. It wasn't all like squatters or just giving land. They had the possession of that for the land that they were giving up, and they were to go immediately there, and so they prepared for that. In the meantime, then, the war broke out between the colonies in England, and in which the Brothertons then were sort of like put on hold. Some of them fought for the colonies, some of them fought for England, and some of them didn't fight. They just were neutral. After the war was over, then they moved to New York and established a town. In 1785, they decided to name their town, and so Samson Occum named the town Iamquitowakinak. It means in Indian, town of brothers living together in peace. When they lived in Bretherton, New York, because of the lands they gave up farther east, they had a superintendent. Everything is written down. Got field books. We have how much they spent on their corn, their wheat, who plowed their fields. And in Brotherton, what they wanted them to do was to learn how to farm, put up the fences, and which was not natural for the Native Americans, and develop their own little area. And they did a very good job of that and learned the skills. It is a nice little area. It looks the same as Brotherton, Wisconsin, to some extent. The river's running by and the farmland, you look out over it, there's fields of corn. Well, wherever there was good land, farmland or whatever, that's what the settlers wanted. And so that's what they were pushed off of. It was just a short time after they settled there that you can kind of imagine what happened. More settlers came in, the soldiers and the people that were in charge were new, inexperienced. General Washington and all of them then became president, and they had the War of 1812 that had to occur. Okay, now they're settled in and they're doing just exactly what was happening before by the English King George. So now they were being asked to move out of Brotherton, New York, and go to the Michigan Territory. Wisconsin was part of the Michigan Territory then, and so they moved to around Green Bay, Wisconsin, and then they wanted them to move away from there. During the same period of time, the Michigan Territory became Wisconsin Territory. Wisconsin Territory became Wisconsin State, and every time that happened, the regulations and the rules for where they wanted Indians kept changing. So they moved here to Wisconsin, and everything looked good. They had their mill, they had their boat building, they had their fields, their towns were settled, just like today we would have, you know, the grandma, the garden, the kids, the grandkids, and everything. And they got the announcement they had to pack up everything and go again. And they had no control over saying yes or no, as long as they were wards of the government. And so they negotiated with the government, and one of the options that were given. And if you think of this, the options weren't really options, because if you are familiar with the Trail of Tears of the Choctaw, the Cherokee, the Navajo, all of the different tribes at that time, they were put on marches and they died. So do you want to do that? Or do you want to give up your right to be who you are, your culture, your national identity, and become U.S. citizens? But I don't think they realized that, I mean, the people that asked them to sign the papers were just doing their job. And maybe they thought they were doing us a favor. You know, boy, well, they're gonna be so happy we're doing this for them. Oh boy, if they could only know what the future was bringing, you know? And maybe it was a favor, they got to stay here, you know? And now we can fight it out now, if you wanna call it fighting. But they didn't understand all that writing at the bottom. They were educated, they were intelligent, but they didn't understand government. So they continued as a tribe. And they were considered a tribe after that. But if you get to the government now in Washington, D.C., at the BIA, they say they discontinued the day they signed the paper. So in the morning, they woke up, and they were a Brotherton Indian. And I, the person I identify with is my father's great-grandmother. And I'm a great-grandmother today, and I have great-grandkids, and I think that's not so far back in history if you think of it that way. She had to decide with the others in the tribe whether to pick up her kids, her grandkids, her furniture, whatever you can carry, and move yourself to God knows where, whatever the conditions were, or sign this paper. So she signed the paper. So she woke up in the morning, had her house, her garden, her grandkids, and everything. She decided to sign the paper and did. That night she went to bed, she wasn't an Indian anymore. She was considered a citizen, she had to pay taxes, she had to do all the different things that were so unfamiliar to her that, of course, their money system was different. So when they went to Chilton over here to pay their taxes and they didn't have the $1.25 or the $3, they gave them 1 year to come up with it. And if they didn't have it, they took the land back. And guess who bought the land? Guy that collected the taxes in Chilton. So he got her land, and he got the land of so many others.
Carolyn Andler.
every person got 50 acres. Every person, every man, woman, and child got 50 acres. But all of my ancestors are down here. The William Johnson and his wife Charlotte Skisak Johnson. Mm-hmm. My great great grandma Esther Johnson. She married a John Hammer. He's over here. And my grandma Clarabelle was born here.
Now they actually had 24,000 acres to begin with, right?
24,000 that they divided.
They had squatters that came on.
This whole area over here, east to going towards Michigan, most of that was never ever even lived on by the Brothertons because mostly Germans moved in on that whole area. Just moved in. They just moved in and took over, and that's why they had to start moving away then.
You know, they just left. They went to town. And they stayed here in the Wisconsin area, and they lived. They could vote. And they lived the same lifestyle. You know, you didn't cease to be Indians, and you didn't cease to be identifying with your culture. They had their school. They had a mill. And they had the lumber company that, when the settlers came in, they had a town to come to. Which was the Brotherton town, to buy their supplies or to do their work for them. They had the Protestant church. They were divided a couple of times between which one they wanted to follow, but there were some that stuck with their Indianness, I think as they called it, where they had their old rituals and their old beliefs. And I think it remains that today. Spoke English because there were seven different tribes that went together. They all had their dialects and they all had their, it would be like coming to America and you have a little German accent or a Swedish accent or an Italian accent. It just faded and they encouraged that. So they gave up their language. And once in a while, someone in the tribe will try to let's get a Brotherton language here. And my comment is, we didn't have one. That's why we were Brotherton. But we didn't cease to be Indians and you didn't cease to be identifying with your culture. To me, Indian was Indian, the way I was raised, and you were Brotherton. We just want to be able to call ourselves what we are, and our nation is the Brotherton, and that's our culture, and that defines us. The first time I went in to apply for by one of my sons that was going to go to college to Ashland, Wisconsin, and I asked for them to sign the papers, and at that point, you had to be a recognized tribe, the word recognized. They said, you're not a recognized tribe. What? That was like a blow. Well, what are you talking about, you know? Well, who are you if you don't know where you came from or why you are what you are? It has an impact on your life. And to deny the person the right to be that by just saying, well, why would you want to be it anyway? Why would you want to be Brotherton or Indian? Would be to then have them consider themselves in a different light than everybody else is entitled to. To be Brotherton, to be recognized. 1979 and 80, they started to do this thing that we were then allowed to do as a petition. So we did. And the people available to do it were very few in number, and trying to collect all of that information wasn't easy without computers and all the newfangled things that we have today that where we can get information just by pressing buttons. So it took a long time just to assemble the names of the people, the documents that would be needed, and the procedures to be followed. Plus, over that 30 years, they kept changing what the procedures were, which meant then that we had new criteria, okay? I came into it full time when we were amending the petition, updating everything because it was getting closer to when we could accomplish what we wanted. And there was some goal in sight, whereas before it was just your number 65 and we're on number 4, you know, now we're on number 5. The Pequots had to be acknowledged, and we gave up a space so they could go together and do that, and it went on and on and on. It was like forever. So that's when I became involved, and what we had to do then was like rewrite our and update our constitution. So I worked with that. And then we had to have our different ordinances. We had an enrollment ordinance that had to be written. And I'm a peacemaker now, so we had to write our peacemaker ordinance. We're like the judge. We're like the judicial system of the tribe. There's 5 of us. And we're not too popular if we make decisions that some people don't like. But that comes with the territory. But for the petition itself, that was really involved and really demanding. When we sent our information in December of 2005, we had about 9 or 10 of these huge containers of just documents. They all had to be accurate, had to be in a certain order, and we had to have 3 copies of everything. And that's the kind of work that had to be done. You'd be up half the night, days after days, because once you got on it, you wanted to get to the end of it, you know, and finish it. So that's what my life has been. Then Carolyn Andler was the chairperson, and then she wasn't able to continue. So then I stepped in just because somebody had to be there, because I don't want to be chairman of anything. I didn't feel qualified, but I was. And then when we sent it in, we started waiting. Came back and said that you've been refused because you didn't qualify. Why didn't we qualify? You have to fulfill 7 criteria in order to be accepted back and recognized or acknowledged that you are a tribe. But if you fail one, you fail them all. So what we failed in when we were denied was that we accepted to be citizens in 1839 when we signed that paper. But some officials said, no, that wasn't true. And we have letters, and then we have letters that refer to carbon copies. When we got to the point of pressuring them to give us the letters that stated that we did not give up our right by signing those papers, they couldn't find the letters. And so then they had to decide in Washington whether it was or it wasn't. Who interprets it? Because it's been interpreted by different officials and prevented us from getting our petition approved and being a tribe right now. So then my son wrote a letter back. Oh, well, why didn't you tell us that back, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what are we going to do? Well, finally, one of their attorneys there in Washington, D.C., looked it over, studied, and he says, you know, we're going to just not take your petition into consideration. In fact, we'll never use any of the information from it. You must now go through Congress and be restored. So for 30 years, we worked with the assumption that we hadn't given it up and we had a right to go the process, which was to petition. You cannot petition if you've already been denied the right by Congress in 1839. If that was accurate, they never should have allowed us the right to petition. We would have had to immediately go to the Congress and have Congress approve it.
The one good thing that came out of 30 years of working on the petition is, like her papers, those were at Hamilton College. Mm-hmm. So you have these archives, these little historical societies, some places you wouldn't even think, where they have our history. And for the most part now, most of it is copied and we have it here. So at least we have accumulated our own history here, which we didn't have before. So that's a good thing that came of it.
And a great many tribes don't have. Now we've been relegated to having to go the political way, which is called restoration. We have to restore ourselves. We have to restore that we are like we were when we were our tribe. We're not in that category until we go through the process, and we're going to continue doing that just because of the future. It might not be something that I ever see, but it'll happen someday because it's just a fact.
In 1860, if he can draw a Mohegan warrior on his letter, he's been told who he is, what he is, everything has passed down to him, and he knows he's a Brotherton Indian here, you know. They didn't give up who they were just because they took citizenship.
Brotherton History was funded in part by Irene Danielle Kress, Francis A. and Georgia F. Ahrens Fund of the Community Foundation for the Fox Valley Region, EVU Foundation, Ron and Patty Anderson, Ira and Aneva Riley Baldwin, Wisconsin Idea Endowment, Timothy William Trout Education Fund, National Endowment for the Humanities, and Friends of Wisconsin Public Television.
And this has been part three of Tribal Histories, a Wisconsin history project by Wisconsin Public Television and Wisconsin Historical Society. It was produced and edited by Mick Dirks. The storytellers this hour were Ernie St. Germain and Joan Shadowald. Sound design was by Tom Nounis. Production assistance was by Donna Crane. Director of production was Kathy Beeson. This program was adapted for radio by Jennifer Dargan, Tom Blaine, and Joe Hartke. You can find the video for this program at wpt.org/tribalhistories.